Hello and welcome to Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw. Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com. And to support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. And in this episode, I'm joined by author and podcaster Andy Miller. Hello.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on your new venture. Exciting.
Thank you. Because Backlisted is taking a bit of a hiatus at the moment, is that right?
Yeah, we're having a rest this year, as you and I wearily discussed a while ago. People would be surprised, wouldn't they, about how much we're having huge fun right now, listeners. But
yes,
the admin that goes into any of these things, every person who makes a podcast that I speak to, it tends to be the admin rather than anything else that drives them into the wall eventually. And we were approaching that thing. You know how, Chris, how interviews with bands traditionally say something like, in retrospect, what we should have done is had a holiday and then we wouldn't have split up.
Yes.
We kind of felt we were approaching that point. I mean, we weren't falling out, but we have been on tour for a decade, so we decided we'd have a little time off.
You were madness in the late 80s, were you?
Well, yeah. Arguably one of us will be Morrissey wrapped in a Union Jack at the reunion, but let's not get into that.
So, in this episode, we're looking at an issue of Melody Maker, published on the 30th of November 1968. Melody Maker was founded in 1926, a century ago. And originally it focused on big bands, soon became the number one resource for fans of jazz. As a result, the paper's main rival, New Musical Express, which was launched in 1956, took a lot of its readers as it realised the importance of rock and roll, something which Melody Maker deemed a passing fad. However, by 1964, the paper fully embraced the current singles and albums and wrote about pop music with a reverence that looked way beyond how danceable a song might be, and it became the leading music magazine. It still focused on jazz throughout the 60s and also had an extensive classified section for both readers and musicians. And at this point, the magazine we're going to talk about today, the editor is Jack Hutton, who took on the role in 1962. And under his leadership, he helped shift Melody Maker from mainly jazz coverage to the Beatles, Stones, et al. But he still maintains some of the jazz and blues focuses. He also oversaw a major redesign and technical upgrade, establishing it as one of the UK's most important music papers. So, Andy, before we dive in, what else was happening on the week of 30th of November 1968? In Northern Ireland, the Civil Rights Association marching Armagh stopped by the Royal Ulster Constabulary due to the presence of a Loyalist counter-demonstration led by Ian Paisley. In the US, President Richard Tricky Woo Nixon appoints his new security advisor, Henry Kissinger.
Okay.
Yeah, a few days after that, NBC airs the legendary Elvis comeback special, essentially kickstarting his career. And 3 days after that, the Rolling Stones release Beggar's Banquet, which similarly kind of kickstarted their career after the critical failure of the psychedelic Sgt. Peppercorn, Their Satanic Majesty's Request, which incidentally I love.
Their Satanic Majesty's Request is the best Rolling Stones album, and I shall be taking no further questions at this time.
In the UK singles chart, Hugo Montenegro's at number one, with the theme from The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, while the soundtrack of the film is being held off the top of the album charts by The Hollies' Greatest Hits. In the Billboard charts, Diana Ross and the Supremes celebrate, incredibly, their 11th US number one single in just 4 years with Love Child. While in the US album chart, the Jimi Hendrix Experience Electric Ladyland is knocked off the top to be replaced by Big Brother and the holding company Cheap Thrills.
Yeah.
And as a reflection of the disparity of the time, in the UK the album failed to even chart.
Wow, isn't that fascinating? Yeah, okay, go on.
Yeah, but Andy Miller, I can see you're visibly bursting to ask me the inevitable question. Chris, what was on telly on Saturday.
Chris, what was on? Chris, what was on telly? Can I just point out, I was alive at this time you're talking about. I was literally 6 months old at the point you're talking about. So whatever was on telly, I may well have seen it.
Let's test
it. I have
it
no
out.
Memory of it, but I'll tell you if I think Mum and Dad might have put me in front of the telly for the programme concerned. Go on.
I think there'll be a few here that you'll know, probably from later. Right, what was on BBC One today then? So getting us into the spirit of the swinging 60s, the day commences with developing a small firm for bosses and managers of small firms. Part 8.
I remember that. That was great. That it was the episode with the Rolodex, wasn't it? It was great. It was amazing.
Yeah, making growth decisions, they called it.
Was it? Okay, good.
Held by that cheeky rogue himself, Dennis Mitchell.
Oh, him. Classic Dennis.
At 1:45, strap in. We're about to spend an exhilarating 4.5 hours in the hands of Frank Boff. Yes, it's Grandstand. Today featuring Fight of the Week, horse racing from Newbury, weightlifting from the Tottenham Municipal Hall, more horse racing, motocross from Norwich, rugby league from St Helens, yet more horse racing and motocross, followed by horse racing and motocross. And after all that, Frank gives us a much-needed happy ending as his teleprinter chugs out the classified football results.
Fight of the Week? Presumably boxing.
You'd hope so.
Perhaps they
maybe
did.
Frank Boff was the fight of the week.
Well, we know Frank Boff, he had some dubious habits, so perhaps brawling was one of them.
Then at 6:15, Simon says, put your hands on the BBC button, it's D time.
It's D time!
Simon
Brilliant.
D.
Oh, Simon D. Yeah, go on. An enigma wrapped in a mystery, wrapped in a riddle, Simon
yes,
D.
Yes, yeah.
So famous for a while, then not famous ever again.
No, and not very happy about it, sadly.
No, sadly not. Who was on this particular episode, then?
It doesn't say, or I haven't written it down, although I'd never heard of them, one of those. And that is...
That's showbiz.
That's showbiz. Yeah. Sorry, Simon. And that is followed by gritty, no-nonsense, hard-hitting crime drama, Dixon of Dock Green.
Ah, Dixon of Evening All.
Evening All. Tonight's episode, a man is found in possession of a stolen car and £500 in new tempo notes that he cannot account for. Is his claim to be suffering from a loss of memory a sham? Find out.
It's Frank Boff again. That's what was on television. Frank Boff's Frank Boff's private life in a variety of formats.
Frank Boff's prank hour. Also on ITV, 7:30, Thingamy Bob. Comedy starring Stanley Holiday with the theme tune written by Paul McCartney and performed by the Black Dyke Mills Band.
One of the first singles on Apple.
Yeah, so that was 7:30 p.m.
And that is showbiz. Where are they now? Where are the Black Mills? Well, they're still going, aren't they, in fact? Celebrating 100 years in show business or something.
We are the Village Green Preservation Society. God save the old duck, Bonneville and variety. We are the Desperate Dan Appreciation Society. God save strawberry jam and all the different
varieties. Okay, should we go back to 30th of November 1968 and this issue of Melody Maker? And I think maybe start with something I mentioned, that by the end of the week, the Rolling Stones released Beggar's Banquet. And it was around this time there were a number of significant albums released, with two in particular on the very same day, one of which you've written a book about.
Yes, indeed. Well, when we first talked about this, I immediately thought, oh, I don't think I've ever talked about the Kinks of the Village Green Preservation Society, which is the album we're in question, on a podcast before. And so I was really thrilled to have the opportunity to talk about it with you on this particular show. I wrote one of the very early, in fact, it was the fourth installment in the 33 and a third series of books about LPs, which unbelievably is still going strong 25 years later. And so my book is still in print, which is lovely, and I still get feedback about it from not just Kinks fans, but fans of 60s music and just music, because the Village Green Preservation Society is truly, at this point, a classic album.
Mm.
What's so weird is when I was writing it, that book 25 years ago, it seemed ancient then, and now it seems, even writing the book about it now seems like a historic event to me, something from the past. So it one of the things that Village Green Preservation Society is about, or the songs on it are about, written by somebody, remember, who was 25 or 26 years old at the time, Ray Davies, is nostalgia. And along with Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, perhaps, certain other Beatles songs, the Kinks are perhaps the only group of that era who write songs about what it's like to be old.
Yes.
Or middle-aged or old, and looking back at something that they're still living through. And that's one reason, I think, why Village Green Preservation Society has worn so exceptionally well. It's one of the only records from the 1960s that looks forward to what will happen next.
Mm.
So it's both backwards looking and forwards looking. It's Ray projecting himself into a time many years later where people take pictures of each other just to prove that they really existed, where they think about times when they were happy, or times when they were with their family, or times when they were with a friend. The single that isn't on the album is, of course, Days. One of the singles that isn't on the album, but it's recorded in the same session. Days, later a big hit for Kirsty MacColl, of course. I'm sure everybody listening to this knows that record and will acknowledge what an incredible song that is. A song, not just a record, a song.
Mm.
For a young man of the age of 24, 25, to have come up with such a subtle, nuanced, bittersweet encapsulation of, I suppose you'd say, the pros and cons of memory, is just off the chart brilliant. And off the chart is an appropriate phrase to use, because it died on its arse. Now, putting it in context, one of the reasons the Village Green Preservation Society died on its arse, and there are several, but one reason is it's released on November the 22nd, 1968, perhaps the single stupidest day to release a new album in the whole history of pop music, with perhaps the exception of June the 1st, 1967.
Bowie.
The day the Beatles released Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which was, of course, also the day David Bowie's first album came out.
Yeah.
Again, there are reasons why that album wasn't a big hit, but partly there's no space in the shops for anything except the Beatles. Well, fast forward 18 months, just about to the end of November 1968, everybody's getting their money ready for the records they want for Christmas. The Kinks released this weird little 15-track album about characters and things that teenagers can quite simply not be able to relate to at all. Meanwhile, there's a double album by the Jimi Hendrix Experience. There's a new album by those cheeky Rolling Stones. There's a Beatles album called The Beatles, which retails at nearly £4. This is one of the things that came out of the... Imagine that, everybody. £4 for a copy of the White Album. Which is one of the things that comes over in this issue of Melody Maker, isn't it, Chris? That the discourse, as we would now call it, around the release of a new Beatles album is, obviously, is it any good? But also, quite a lot of it is, this record is so expensive. Even to the extent that Apple are forced to say it's not our fault, it's the government of added VAT driving the price up from what we would wish to charge, a premium price, to a luxury price. So if you had your Christmas list to Santa and you want the new Beatles and Jimi Hendrix records, and let's say that let's chuck in the Rolling Stones, that's the cost of 5 or 6 LPs right there.
Mm.
Buying those 3 albums is going to cost you 6 LPs.
Yes. Yeah.
And meanwhile, you probably won't be able to even find the Village Green Preservation Society in the shops, and it doesn't have any singles on it. So it's like it's doomed from the start.
Yeah.
And again, people have, including myself, have written at length about the extent to which the project was deliberately self-sabotaging and the extent to which it was just completely undone by the band being on the wrong label at the wrong time, seeming incredibly unfashionable. With the result that in this issue of Melody Maker, there is an incredibly precious resource, which is Ray Davies being interviewed about this new Kinks album and going through it track by track, describing each track. And I thought what was interesting when I read this again, because obviously I drew on it for the book, was how unusual that was actually within the music papers at the time. You know, famously, the last time Ray Davies had gone through an album track by track for a music paper, it was Revolver.
Yes.
By the Beatles. And he slags it off and it's all very funny. And but I don't think this was a... You didn't sit down with a member of the Hollies and say, please talk us through Evolution. Or you didn't sit down with any number of other artists and bands mentioned in this issue of the Melody Maker from November 1968. And it does speak of the regard in which Ray Davies was held, both as a brilliant songwriter and also an exception to the rule. When we look back on the 60s, we tend to think of all the bands living in a big house together, really, or in our imaginations, don't we? It's they're all together. There they are. It's the Beatles and the Stones at the top. And then it's probably the Who, the Small Faces, the Kinks, the Move, you know, and they're all, everybody's familiar with them all the same time. That really is not the case with the Kinks. By late 68, they are seen as both passé, and they never really fitted in the first place. They aren't really a rock group or a pop group as either rock or pop have come to be defined by that period. They're this weird little cabaret turn that backs what the guy who was known as the Noel Coward of pop. And he was known as the Noel Coward of pop because that's how the management referred to him. They marketed him as the Noel Coward of pop. So you've got Lennon and McCartney being compared in this issue to Schubert, which we'll come on to. And then somewhere over there on the sidelines is Ray Davies, this strange chap from North London who writes songs about having your tea and your Sunday lunch and contributes numbers to satirical television shows like At the 11th Hour and Where Was Spring. So I have speculated that lots of the Village Green Preservation Society was written not for the Kinks, but to be a Ray Davies solo project, just as Dave Davies was having hit singles with Death of a Clown and Susanna's Still Alive, which were recorded with the Kinks. So it seems likely that lots of the songs on Village Green Preservation Society were created for a Ray solo record. And at the final moment, somebody's nerve failed.
Wow.
I don't know whose. It may well be that the record company, Pye, who were notoriously square, said, you must be joking. There's no singles on this thing as it is. So if we put it out under your name, it's going to do absolutely nothing. I don't know. That's pure speculation. But yeah, so imagine that. You've made your greatest artistic statement. And I personally think Village Green is Ray's greatest artistic statement. And it comes out and it does nothing, and it's absolutely dwarfed by all the other records in the shop at that time.
Weeks now, number three stood empty. Nobody thought there would be. Family left up behind the windows or a Christmas tree.
As a timeline, I mean, like you say, 22nd of November, you've got Kinks, Village Green, same day as the White Album. On the 6th of December, you got the Stones' Beggar's Banquet. And prior to that, you also had Electric Ladyland. And then I was wondering the same thing with the Kinks. Not long after this, the Pretty Things released SF Sorrow, which similarly did nothing for years. And then years later, suddenly people came back to it.
Well, that's interesting. You've also got, by the way, can I just say, when you were talking about the album chart there, you've also got the Holly's Greatest Hits sitting at number one, and you've got the Seekers at the Talk of the Town sitting at number two. But if you're a record buyer, don't underestimate the extent to which you want good value for money from albums which cost quite a lot, and therefore an album that's got all the best, quote-unquote, Holly's tracks on it. Yes, please.
Mm.
You know, that's serious competition. Actually, and but with the, in the case of the Pretty Things, that's really interesting, because the Pretty Things will have been able to rely on what would have been called an underground audience. Now, they're not going to sell loads of records, but kind of heads and hip cats would be onto that. So there is a kind of built-in audience for them. And my point is, really, at this point in the Kinks' career, nobody knows who their audience is.
No.
They're not in the chart. They won't be back in the charts properly till Lola is a big hit in 1970. And they haven't been in the charts with a big hit single since Autumn Almanac in 1967. And before that, Waterloo Sunset. Now, to us, this doesn't sound very far apart, does it? But as everybody says, the gap from late 67 to early 1970 in pop terms is absolutely huge, and never more so than in the period from 67 to 70, which coincides with the change in the market from pop to rock, or at least a bifurcation of pop and rock, caused by, in no small part, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Albums become the property of rock groups, singles become the property of pop groups. In the middle are the Kinks, appealing to no one apart from middle-aged men 50 years later. And when you were talking about the different records that were out there, I am aware that the story that the LP wasn't in the shops is tempting. It's not true. You could go and buy a Kinks LP if you sort it out. But one thing Pye always did was they were more of a singles-based operation. They weren't geared up to exploit the underground in the way that SF Sorrow was on EMI, wasn't it? It was on Columbia, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah.
You know, so EMI was a bigger company with a wider spread of penetration into various different markets. Pye didn't have that. Fundamentally, they were a singles outfit. They sold many, many copies of Kinks albums when they put them out on their budget label, Marble Arch, which would sell through Woolworths and whatever. And at, when Village Green comes out, within weeks or months, another Best of the Kinks or Kinks Old Tracks album comes out. Of course, that does fantastically well.
Yeah.
Because the Kinks audience have already been trained by Pye to focus on singles or LPs that collect singles.
Mm.
But the idea of this thing called an album group, which is still a fresh creation, forget it. They're nowhere there.
Yeah.
And this is one reason why for so many years, I mean, he changed his mind in the last 20 years, which is brilliant. But for so many years, Ray was totally dismissive of the Village Green Preservation Society. And suspicious of anyone who said, this is your best work. His response was traditionally along the lines of, well, what are you talking about?
Mm.
Nobody got it at the time. And I mucked it up. It's badly recorded. And, you know, it's so, so, so interesting.
Poor old Ray.
So it kind of, it just, even within the context of the magazine you've given me from the actual time when the record comes out, it's almost, we'll come on to the actual interview, but I find it hard to imagine any young pop fan putting down that interview, crossing the Beatles off their Christmas list,
yes,
and writing in the Kinks are the Village Green Preservation Society.
Yes.
It's a massive title, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah, November the 30th, or the 22nd of November. It's purely the Christmas market.
but misunderstands. She's often inclined to borrow somebody's dreams till tomorrow. There is no other day.
Can you remember how I was thinking how I first got into the Kinks? Because I heard, do you remember her old record club on Radio 1 back in the 70s?
Yes.
Hosted by, you know, him.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
But they played See Emily Play by Pink Floyd, and I loved it. I was only a kid, and I absolutely loved it. And I didn't catch who'd sung it. And for years, I was desperate to find out this song, because all I knew was, all I could remember was Till Tomorrow. And I heard, years later, I heard a Kinks song, and I thought, that sounds like that bloke that sang that Till Tomorrow song.
Till Tomorrow song.
So I bought a double album for about $2.99, one of these Stars of Yore collections, and I played it, and I thought, hang on, none of these have got that Till Tomorrow song on. And then I thought, actually, these are brilliant, and I got them completely by mistake.
That's so interesting. Can you remember what the LP was that you accidentally bought?
It was... I think it was called Spotlight on the Kinks.
Yes, I can see it in my mind's eye.
Yes, yeah.
Well, this was one of the things in the 70s, again, because the Kinks changed labels in 71, maybe, 70, 71, and went on to make a series of further excellent to less good albums, none of which were terribly commercially successful. But all their hits remained with Pye, or with organisations that bought the Pye back catalogue. Yeah. And so they were constantly going up against weird compilations that would pop up in Woolworths. It's like the Woolworths and the Kinks were sort of enemies. the secret drag on the Kinks' reputation was the fact that you could buy their new concept album, Schoolboys in Disgrace, or you could go for half the price and buy something that's got Waterloo Sunset, Autumn Almanac, Dead End Street, these incredible songs on it.
Mm.
I think my introduction to the Kinks was not dissimilar to what you're talking about, was that I first became aware of this thing, the 60s, when I, obviously the Beatles, and then I started to become aware of records like As Time Goes by Marianne Faithfull, or Lazy Sunday by the Small Faces. Mm. Records you would hear on Radio 2, or even still on Radio 1 when we were kids, right?
Yeah.
So I remember hearing of all the records in the world, Pretty Flamingo by Manfred Mann, and being absolutely blown away by it. Not unreasonably, it's a great record, but also because it sounds like something from the Monkees.
Yeah.
So one's way into the music of the 60s was through the Beatles and the Monkees. You know, you would hear the Beatles everywhere, and the Monkees were on TV in school holidays.
Yes.
And then gradually you pick up from the radio other records from the 60s. I think I was aware of the Kinks. I was aware of Waterloo Sunset. I bought, like, do you remember Old Gold, the record label that reissued? So I had an Old Gold single of Waterloo Sunset.
Yeah.
I bought the single Come Dancing when that came out in 1983, their last big hit. A fantastic record, then and now. And I think I bought a Kinks Greatest Hits when I was still at school. So I'm kind of up to speed with the Kinks. But I don't buy an actual Kinks LP, like so many members of the public. You can't get them anywhere in the 80s.
Yes, yeah.
They were really difficult to find. And then PRT reissued the whole 60s back catalogue in 87 or 88. And that was the thing. So I would have been about 20 then. And that was the thing that really took the top of my head off. I can remember listening to Village Green Preservation Society for the second or third time and thinking, but this is all singles. This is 15 Autumn Almanacs. This is just the most incredible outpouring of creativity.
Yeah.
But again, there wasn't any... We sound old, don't we?
Nah.
There wasn't really anywhere you could go to find out more. There were one or two books. There was a John Savage's book about the Kinks. And there was a book by Johnny Rogan, but that was it.
Yes.
You know, unless you had a pass to the British Library, which you didn't, or the Sound Archive in South Kensington. You couldn't do what we're doing now. No. You couldn't just whistle up a 1968 copy of The Melody Maker.
No.
There weren't books. There weren't... A broader point is I was having a chat recently with an academic gentleman from John Moores University in Liverpool. And he was 10, 15 years older than us.
Mm.
And he said, the thing about your lot, meaning Generation X,
right,
is, and I think he's right, he said, you're the first generation that tries to make sense of it all. In my generation, we just lived through it.
Yeah.
You are the ones who, in the 70s, begin to separate this record from that record, or say, this is in this lineage, or you can see connections between this and that.
Mm.
And I think that's really, really true. And I think Generation X, for want of a better term, is responsible for the life that an album like Village Green Preservation Society has had. We are the ones who found it amidst the rubble of the 60s.
Yes.
Just lying there. We are the ones who picked it up, put it on and went, wow, this is great. Actually, I think Generation X has got a lot to do with the reputation of Ram by Paul McCartney.
Definitely.
Ram was not a record that people liked.
No.
Let's be absolutely clear. The other Beatles didn't like it. Record buyers were very disappointed with it at the time. It's us. It's our lot. Let's stick up for Gen X.
Yeah.
It's our lot who sifted through what was left and went, put that on one side. That's a good one.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
And we're the best.
We are the best. Let me return to the topic in hand, which is I love the Kinks and I love 1960, late 68. And I almost think it's hilarious that someone in the pie marketing department had to sit down and go, do we have to put this record out? It's going to do nothing.
Yeah.
It's going to do nothing. But here we are all these 60 blah years later. Still
well, as well as that, it's completely at odds with everything. I mean, it's looking back to this possibly existing, possibly not existent English countryside past. But obviously, I guess the impact of the American, you know, couldn't tour America, that must have had an impact on his songwriting.
I think that's true, yeah. The Kinks were it's all quite lost in the fog of mists of time now, but they had been banned from touring in the States because of some... They'd upset a union during a TV appearance at some point in 65 or 66. So they couldn't tour America. But I think also what it's about is Ray Davies's undergoing quite a significant depression and personal crisis anyway in his mid-20s.
Mm.
And it speaks to me more of that. It's not so much, I think the Englishness is a bit of a red herring, but I think the being at home and what home meant and the fact that home might have disappeared and couldn't be regained, that is the kind of pastoral, English pastoral thing you're talking about. The sense that there was, as Orson Welles said, an England where the hay was always smelt sweeter and the village green was the place where young people frolicked and were happy. That's a literary trope.
Mm.
Now, whether Ray picked that up deliberately or by accident, I've no idea. But the lost innocence is a big thing, and we should also note when the ban was lifted and the Kinks did go back to the States, they had a big audience waiting for them, curated by Rolling Stone magazine and the Underground. So the cachet that they lacked in the UK built for them in their absence in the States. Rolling Stone absolutely loved Village Green, absolutely loved Arthur in particular.
Mm.
I think Arthur might have been Rolling Stone's album of the year in 69.
Ah.
Imagine being Rolling Stone's album of the year in 1969, another year full of incredible records.
Yes.
And you've got the Bible of the Woodstock generation saying, you need to look at this record from England.
Wow.
You know, they... So when they do get back to America, that people are waiting to see them. Brilliantly, when they do get back to America, the music industry has changed so much that on their first US tour is the first time they've ever used a PA.
Oh, really?
Yeah. because in the mid to late 60s, they're still playing UK package tours of cinemas, of course, and yeah. variety halls. They're in Cabaret, disastrously, in Batley in Yorkshire. So they're playing through the back line. Mm. they've got no experience of being the band that they were in the early 60s, this proto-heavy metal band.
Yeah.
They have to go back to America again and be handed, you know, some high-watt amps and a decent PA and some new equipment.
Yeah.
And they start morphing into the rock band they became in the 70s. But at the time we meet them, they're like, I don't know, they're Patrick Troughton. You were talking about the Invaders, it's like four Patrick Troughtons in a group.
Yeah. So again, yeah, we're looking at the Melody Maker, November the 30th, 1968. And on the front cover, we have a headline, £1 million for Beatles' new LP.
I told you it was expensive.
The Beatles' new double album, The Beatles, has already taken more than 1 million in advance orders. EMI have had advance orders in excess of 300,000 for the album, which now costs £3.14.10 after the government extra purchase tax has been applied. There's more of that on page 4. But it talks about the group's projected live appearances will now probably be postponed until January, said press officer Derek Taylor. But they will take place at London's Roundhouse, probably in mid-December. So obviously that's the beginning of Get Back. Would evolve into that.
Doesn't he say, and that's a promise? Doesn't Derek Taylor say, and that's a promise?
Oh, yeah, it's likely they will be postponed until mid-January, but they will take place at that surprise.
I'm not saying Derek Taylor wasn't a man of his word, but, you know, as we know, things did not turn out that way.
Exactly, yeah. There's also an interesting line here from Derek where he says, with George Harrison returning from his American trip by liner, it would be excessively adventurous to think we could get the shows together by mid-December. But I like that because that's when George and Patty famously hooked up with Frank Sinatra. And Frank, obviously, the first Apple One was Frank singing The Lady is a Champ for Maureen.
For Maureen, yeah.
Bless him.
Is that the trip where George famously is hanging out with Dylan and then comes back to...
Yeah.
Comes back to England to be treated like the tea boy. Thinks I might have had enough of this now.
Yeah. Other headlines, we've got Engelbert Humperdinck, his dinkles always being humpled, plans big UK tour for the new year. Ronnie Scott's band gets Newport offer. And inside, we're promised whatever's come over Diana Ross, John Walker out of the wilderness, and Louis Armstrong, just how great is he? All inside.
That's so interesting. Melody Maker, it reminded me reading this, that Melody Maker in this era was as much about jazz, folk and blues as it was about pop music.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
You know, they're not just the small ads at the back, which I'm sure we'll get to, but how much coverage is given to all those genres within this end of year episode issue.
Yeah.
You know, overviews of the blues scene in 68. And yet you can feel pop is the thing that wishes to burst to the front of the paper.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? Did you not get that feeling?
Oh, yeah.
The writing on pop is significantly more energetic and, as they would have said then, clearly where the action is. But yeah, so that front page, which is such a weird combination of acts, isn't it? Diana Ross, John Walker, Ronnie Scott. Fascinating, fascinating.
We are the moles and we stay in the hole.
We turn to page 2,
I very much enjoyed on page two. There's two things I really liked here, but other than the chart. Obviously, I love the charts, because who doesn't love the charts? There's an article called Simon's No Mole. And it says, Simon Dupree is not a mole. In last week's MM, Raver reported that the Moles, whose mystery record, We Are the Moles, has been played on Radio 1 with Simon, members of the Big Sound. This week, Simon told the Melody Maker, I hope the record will be a big hit, but I personally don't like it and have no wish to be associated with it. Neither I nor any of the group have anything whatsoever to do with the Moles. And that was a huge lie. He doesn't even... what I like about it is he doesn't even make it seem ambiguous. No. He just says, how dare you? How dare you associate me with this record I both sing on and play instruments with the rest of my band? How dare you?
Yeah, it's serious.
And also, I love, there's a little advert at the bottom of page two, which just says, Fairport... Soon! Exclamation mark. Yeah. Ireland, ILPS 9092, convention.
Yeah.
So Ireland, who presumably didn't have much money, have paid for a tiny little advert for the early 1969 release, or late 68 release, of What We Did On Our Holidays by Fairport Convention. The first Fairport album on Ireland. And that's what you got. That was the big push. A tiny, tiny advert on the bottom of page two of the Melody Maker.
But yeah, going back to that Moles thing... Because it was so deliberate. It was unbelievable. Because it was on Parlophone. And it was so deliberate. Because it appeared on the 15th of November 1968. And the Matrix number was R5743. Which is in between Hey Jude and Get Back. And and the Beatles...
It is nothing to do with either the Beatles or... Why are you bringing this up?
Yeah. But it was backed by a publicity story claiming that the master tape had been mysteriously left in a train station locker and sent anonymously to the press. And but I remember hearing it was on bootlegs back in the Beatles bootlegs.
Yeah, it was right. So there's all this circumstantial evidence pointing to it being a Beatles affiliated, at least.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's true, but they say Sid Barrett was the one who gave the game away. But I don't know if that's true or not.
Really?
That's what I found. Don't know if that's true.
Sid Barrett gave it, what, in 19... At that point, 1968, I highly doubt it. I don't think he was in a position to do that, was he? He wasn't very well by that point.
No, bless him. No.
And, of course, XTC, as the Dukes of Stratosphere, many years later, record a song called The Mole from the Ministry, which... owes a huge debt to I Am the Walrus, but also to this record.
Absolutely.
Right?
And Andy Partridge, another huge Village Green fan.
All right-thinking people are, Chris. I hope you are.
Of course.
Are you?
Yes.
Okay, that's all a few. We can continue.
So we've got the Melody Maker Top 30 chart. We've got the singles number one, as I say, is Hugo Montenegro with Good, Bad, The Ugly. Top 20 albums, number one, Holly's Greatest Hits. We've also got the US Top 10, Love Child, Diana Ross and Supremes. It's also got the Pop 30 Publishers chart, which number one's United Artists.
United Artists, of course. Yes. And Carlin at two.
Mm.
And Joe Beat BMI, which was the Motown publisher, wasn't it?
Yeah. So,
how many of those records do you know in the top 30 singles chart?
Well, all of them, because I've done a playlist. But prior to that, probably The Gun at number 29 I hadn't heard.
Yeah.
I'm
just... We're not going to, but if we had to sing the chorus of... these records that came out 60 years ago, I reckon I know the choruses of two-thirds of those records.
Yes.
Which is pretty incredible when you think about it, isn't it?
Oh, big time.
So we've got The Good, The Bad, and The... A theme from The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. Eloise, This Old Heart of Mine, Breaking Down the Walls of Heartache, Lily the Pink, Eleanor, All Along the Watchtower, I'm a Tiger, with a little help from my friends, I ain't got no I got life. Miraculously, even though I was only 6 months old at the time, I know all those records. Yeah, actually, tiny, tiny Kinks-related thing. There's a brilliant song by the Kinks called Where Did My Spring Go?, which was written for a TV show in early 1969, which I worked out is a parody of I Ain't Got No I Got Life by Nina Simone.
Oh, really?
So where the song from Hair, which is where it comes from, by Nina Simone goes, I've got my, you know, hands, got my feet, got my da 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 da. The Kinks song, classic Ray Davis, goes, where did my hair go? Where did my spring go? Where did my go go? Yeah. It's a list of negatives rather than positives. Absolute perfect.
Oh, superb.
Ray stuff. I'm just looking at this chart and thinking, if we left out the Beatles' Hey Jude, and let's say we'll take I'm the Urban Spaceman also for granted, and those were the days, all records with Beatles connections. What's your favourite record in that top 30? Go.
Jessamine by the Casuals.
What am I supposed to do with a girl like Jessamine? Though my eyes are open wide, she's made my life a dream. When Jessamine goes, a part of me knows I'm not really.
Okay, so I think one of Paul Weller's favourite ones. Because that was written by Marty Wilde. In fact, there's two singles in this chart written by Marty Wilde. Can you guess the other one? Casuals.
Oh, blimey.
Jessamine and another one.
Is it Only One Woman by Marbles?
No, it's in the top 10.
Oh, is it? Is it I'm a Tiger by any chance?
It is. Yes.
That's a good record, though, I'm a Tiger.
Yeah. But it's weird because Marty Wilde, what he did, he worked with Ronnie Scott, not that one, but his mate, and they published the Casuals one under a pseudonym, because Marty was obviously, he didn't want his identity to be revealed if it wasn't a hit. And originally the lyrics went, When Rosemary Goes, but Marty suggests changing it to Jessamine, which was the name of a Merseyside cafe where his mother-in-law lived.
Quick, I must go and find it. Sorry, I've got to go. Got to go, Chris.
Yeah, but it's great because Marty did eventually record a version himself. He did an album in 1969, which I love. It's called Diversions.
I have a copy of it.
Do you?
I do, yes.
Fantastic.
I'm very familiar with it, yes. Yeah.
What can you say when a girl doesn't want to know? She's too far away, and she makes my life a dream. When Jessamine goes.
I, in common with many other people, such as the writer Rob Chapman, who wrote a brilliant piece in Mojo about 30 years ago on this very topic, I love the sort of clueless, trying to get hip, late 60s records by artists. I've got an album by Pat Boone, of all people, which is his kind of, I'm just a travelling hobo, travelling on. He's got a recording of The Dolphins by Fred Neil on it. I mean, and they're not, the thing is, it would be wrong to think that they're so bad they're good. They're not. They're totally fascinating because they're trying to get with whatever the vibe is and whatever the kids are buying. And sometimes it doesn't work and sometimes they're great. There's some amazingly good Billy Fury records on Parlophone in the mid to late 60s.
Oh, yes.
While he tries to find a new niche for himself.
Mm.
I think my favourite records here are Harper Valley PTA by Jeannie C. Riley. Ah. There's a fantastic episode of the podcast Cocaine and Rhinestones about Jeannie C. Riley, Harper Valley PTA, and Tom T. Hall, who wrote the song, which was a huge, huge hit on the country chart in the States first, and then crossed over into pop. I can recommend that to everybody. And then I probably...
It's tough.
I mean, it's hard, isn't it? It's tough, isn't it? Like, you know, Eleanor's an amazing record, All Along the Watchtower. Obviously, that's a fantastic record. My other favourite record in this list, I've got two others. I love Build Me Up Buttercup, as does anyone who's ever seen There's Something About Mary, which it plays over the closing credits of There's Something About Mary. Do you remember it?
I remember the song. I've never seen the film.
You've never seen There's Something About Mary?
Do I need to?
Yeah! I don't even like many of their other films. I've rarely laughed so much in a cinema.
Oh, okay.
So I love that record. But I really love, probably, Beatles' arch enemy, Engelbert Humperdinck, still going strong in 2026, by the way.
Yes.
In his 90s, I believe. His single, Les Bicyclettes de Belle Size, was the featured track from a film called Les Bicyclettes de Belle Size, which was filmed in and around Hampstead and Hampstead Heath, as the name suggests, Belsize Park in North London, and was a sort of British response to the French musical Les Parapluies de Cherbourg. So it's a kind of sung-through film. And the second thing about Les Bicyclettes de Belle Size is it used to be on Channel 4 in the early days of Channel 4 every few weeks. They'd stick it on as a placeholder in the afternoon or late at night.
Okay.
And so I've probably seen it more than I've seen, Billy Liar or a good film.
Yeah.
So I'm terribly attached to it, because this is one of the Village Green things. It doesn't remind me of the 60s. It reminds me of me in the 80s being obsessed with the 60s.
Yes.
You know, it's got all these layers of memory attached to it. What we would call, what posh literary types would call a palimpsest of different layered times of your life when you think about it. And so I'm sitting here today talking about it to you and thinking, yeah, okay, Les Bicyclettes de Belle Size is now a thing that's going to remind me of being in my late 50s, my teens and 6 months old.
Yes.
And it's, Chris, it's not even any good.
But it's the same thing with, because Channel 4 were great when they came up, but they show The Prisoner and all of that, and Ready, Steady, Go. When Ready, Steady, Go was on Channel 4.
Well, this absolutely... so many films and TV shows, like the ones you mention, I encountered first via what was put out late at night on Channel 4 in the 80s. And I returned to that point about I made in the first bit about Generation X. The generation that lives through it experiences it one way. In the case of The Prisoner, it isn't even networked on ITV, some of it. So it depended what region you lived in, whether you got to see it or not. And it's my lot, our lot, who are the ones who, or someone at Channel 4 who goes, well, we could show The Avengers and we could show The Twilight Zone.
Yes.
And we could show, because that's the good stuff. And it's taken that long for it to settle.
Yes.
That's what I mean. It's all the big bang of it is in the decade. Then you can't see any of it in the 70s. And then in the 80s, here comes this new channel and they can start curating a version of the 60s for us to enjoy.
Yes.
Which again, I find at this point now, all these years later, 40 years or more on from that, in turn, I find that really endlessly interesting. In other words, the stuff that the boomers experienced, their version is different to my version and your version, which will be different again for my son's generation.
Of course.
My son my son is in his early 20s, big, big Kinks fan.
Oh, really?
Despite me liking them, he still managed to overcome that.
Yeah.
And Andy Lewis was saying, the musician and DJ Andy Lewis was saying, when you look at somebody like the Lemon Twigs, who fundamentally are my son's generation, they're in their mid to late 20s. Mm. This stuff is so good that every generation comes along and makes their own version of it. curates their own version of it.
I find it amusing if you look at footage of Lemon Twigg's live performances, the range of ages in the audience. You've got your bald-headed men with ponytails and young kids, you know, and it's...
The first time I saw the Twigs, I cannot tell a lie, the most overexcited people in the room were not the students and teenagers, but the old men like myself in Cheap Trick t-shirts going, now this is how you do it. Look, he did a scissor kick. Kids, look, he's windmilling. You know, I could not love them any more than I do. They are fantastic at what they do.
Brilliant.
So the Lemon Twigs are the sort of band who, if they hear this, because I know you've interviewed them before, Chris, guys, why don't you do a one-off gig where you play the whole top 30 from November 68?
Yeah.
Play all these 30 singles. You could manage them. You've probably got half of them in your set already.
Like sweet morning dew, I took one look at you, and it was plain to see you were my destiny.
With arms open wide, I threw away my pride. Sacrifice for you, dedicate my life to you. I'll go where you lead,
on,
always there in time.
Going back to this singles chart, at number 20, You're All I Need to Get by Tammy Terrell and Marvin Gaye. Somebody, Sam Mendes maybe, stop what you're doing, do this instead. Make a movie about Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. Because they're like, obviously, Motown's most beloved duets. Ain't No Mountain High Enough, Your Precious Love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing. And their chemistry was so convincing. But they always said, no, we were just friends and soulmates. But I don't know. I think it's like the Shakespearean quality, because Tammy obviously had been in an abusive relationship with David Ruffin. Marvin was in a pretty unhappy marriage to Anna Gordy Kay, Berry Gordy's sister. But when you see, I don't know if you've seen footage, there's a few different versions, but there's one particular version of Tammy and Marvin miming Ain't No Mountain High Enough. It's the one where she's the same height as him because she was standing on a box, apparently.
Yeah.
It's the only way. And it's basically Romeo and Juliet, sadly, with the same conclusion. Because obviously, 67, she collapsed in his arms. And when she died, he was distraught, wasn't he? It was just... But what a story.
You know, we're familiar with the phrase guilty pleasure, aren't we? And lots of people have railed against that term.
Yeah.
And they say, well, I'm not, why should I have a guilt over pleasure? Well, I'll give you, let me slightly redefine what I mean by guilty pleasure. I love Marvin Gaye's records. Who doesn't? I agree with you about Tammy Terrell, but here's my guilty pleasure. The first few David Ruffin LPs after he went solo. Now, David Ruffin was quote unquote not a nice man.
No.
And it is necessary to separate the art from the artist in this particular case. But, oh my, those first couple of David Ruffin albums, one of which I actually bought, I finally got a vinyl copy of in a charity shop round the corner from here, much to my amazement. That was a good day. And then he recorded a third LP, which wasn't released by Motown, but finally got a vinyl release via Third Man Records, Jack White's label, about 5 years ago. Those are fantastic records.
Mm.
So soulful, so spiritual, and unfortunately, the product of a really not a decent human being in many ways.
Yeah.
But that's a guilty pleasure. You know, yeah. I would prefer, as I'm sure for all sorts of reasons, that was not the case. But I can't deny the fact that he was a ferocious talent and a deeply unhappy individual. But you're right about the Marvin and but then Tammy Terrell is a really sad example of someone who should have been here much longer and gone on to do incredible things.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
You got a you. I just can't live without you. I really want you ever know near me. Your looks intoxicate me. Even though your folks hate me, there's no one like you, Eleanor. Really.
Just briefly at six, Eleanor by the Turtles. Mm-hmm. I think this is the Turtles equivalent of Lazy Sunday by the Small Faces, because White Whale Records wanted more songs like Happy Together. Yeah. And they're also keen to get more expendable. So they did that great album, Battle of the Bands, which is a concept album, really. It's about each track they're pretending to be a different band. But Eleanor was basically a parody of themselves. They were kind of taking the piss out of themselves just to annoy White Whale Records. But obviously the joke backfired because they put it out as a single. But I love it. It's almost a nastier version of the Ruttles. And it's just got that Eleanor G. It's so just sarcastic. I think you swear.
You're my pride and joy, etc. That's right. But that's a classic. This is a thing, right? This is a thing about the 60s I really, really love. I always go back to this. The idea that it was all about love and peace and, you know, getting on with people is only a little bit true. Actually, the dominant mode of the 60s is often really sarcastic and snarky. right from Room at the Top through Smashing Time, through all these other all these other documents. Beatles records, come on, could be very sharp-edged, sharp-elbowed, right? And I'm sure you know this, but the next Turtles album, which is called Turtle Soup,
yes,
was produced by Ray Davis of the Kinks, specifically because, in an act of self-sabotage, the Turtles, who failed miserably to piss off White Whale, they tried to, but they've all scored this huge hit single. Yeah. They go, how can we really fuck with White Whale now? Oh, I know what we'll do. We need to get the guy in who produced Village Green Preservation Society. That died on its arse. And so they fly Ray over to the States before the Kinks ban is lifted, though that trip is instrumental in it being lifted. While he's there, he has conversations he needs to have to record Turtle Soup. And of course, Turtle Soup sounds like a Kinks record from that period. It's quite boxy and small.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And rather brilliant, of course.
Absolutely.
Wonderful Eggpod Express.
Turn to page three.
Yeah.
The main headline is Dylan's Don't Look Back for Middle Earth. Middle Earth was formerly the Electric Garden Club. It was a hippie club in London. It was really a successor to the UFO club. And, it's the documentary will be shown on Saturday the 30th.
Do you remember the first time you saw that film? Not at Middle Earth, presumably.
No, it would have been, again, Channel 4 in the 80s.
I think it was on in the mid-80s, on TV, yeah.
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 And I was most shocked at seeing Donovan, because I always thought, well, I didn't really know the story then, but I thought they were the arch nemesis.
I find Don't Look Back an interesting watch now. I find it quite a difficult watch, because, again, Bob Dylan doesn't strike me as a terribly charming individual, and he's certainly surrounded by some of the worst people ever to have walked the earth, as far as I can tell. I love Dylan. The world is a much better place for having had Bob Dylan in it, doing his various mad Bob Dylan-ish type things. But I think I watch that film and I feel really, it makes me feel edgy. I think, no, don't say that to Bob Dylan. He's going to be really arsy with you. Don't do that, please. Right. And he also, his wit is somewhat overstated, I think. So a journalist will say to him, do you have any songs? And he'll just go, well, I don't know, man. Do you have any papers? I think, well, okay. It's not Oscar Wilde, is it? I mean, you know, What's your message?
I don't know. What's your message, man? Well, yeah, all right.
Very clever, yeah. Very clever, Bob, yeah. But, I mean, amazing, an amazing film.
Because in the previous issue, there was a review of Don't Look Back by Max Jones. And I found it really perceptive. He says, Don't Look Back, the Bob Dylan film, is out at last. And a pretty impressive documentary it is. That is, I must add, if you are capable of being impressed at Bob Dylan's strange voice and character, non-admirers would probably wish to leave before the last crow. A note in the National Film Festival says, this informally filmed record of Bob Dylan's 1965 English tour is unlikely to alter anyone's assessment of his artistic merits. Correct. And no more will it alter their feelings about his personal charm or lack of it. He is, as I expected him to be, and the hard time he gives reporters in the film is much like the treatment I saw handed out at other gatherings on the tour. The softer, more engaging characteristics, the humour and the preoccupation with music are caught too. The purpose of the plot, or non-plot, is to show us a serious, questioning artist, entertainer at work and recreation. The film could have gone further. It would have done no harm to know more of what Dylan feels about the music stream he comes from and contributes to, and less, perhaps, of what he thinks of uninformed interviewers. But that is what it set out to do, and it's strikingly successful. Maybe if the journalists had asked wiser questions, they'd have got more answers.
Well, Max Jones, I think that is fair, but you do Bob Dylan too much of a... pay too Bob Dylan too much respect there. I think every interviewer was on a hiding to nothing because Bob Dylan's obviously so bored and so pissed off with being asked the same questions over and over again. It's all a game to him. So, but that is perceptive. You're quite right. Yeah. Again, we take it for granted that we're all familiar with Don't Look Back and we've all seen it multiple times and it's easy to get to see. But this reminds us that it wouldn't have been shown on television. If you wanted to see it, you had to be sufficiently plugged in that you went to the London Film Festival or you attended a midnight or 2 a.m. screening at a counterculture venue.
Yeah.
You forget all this, don't we? We forget all this. We forget how uncontained this all was. It's just like someone's managed to get hold of the reels of Don't Look Back and we need to find somewhere to screen it. And if you miss it, you miss it. It won't come round again till no one knows when.
Because I remember I had a Dylan book I read when I was a kid, and it mentioned this film. And I think it also mentioned Eat the Document, which I just assumed I'd never see. But, it was weird reading books in the 80s, Beatles books as well, reading things about Two Virgins, say, by John, or Don't Look Back by Bob Dylan. And I just assumed I would never experience those because they've been the album had deleted. Yeah. And I just, that's something I'll never know about. And there was a lot of that at the time, I think.
Just think, you could walk from where you are now. I don't know where you are now. But there's a good chance you could find a record shop fairly close where you could buy a lovely pristine copy of Life with the Lions. Anytime you want to hear that, we could play it now. We could sit here in silence and listen to it. Or we could not do that. Yeah. No, you're so right. Oh, I love Eat the Document. To have gone from, I know exactly what you mean. It's a really good point. To have gone from thinking, I wonder if I'll ever get to see that, to watching cruddy nth generation videotapes to a decent bootleg on DVD and then just to go on YouTube and there it is looking spiffy to the point where you and I both could quote reels of line from Eat the Document. What a journey to go from thinking you'll never see something to be able to go, you booed. No, it wasn't me, Bob. No, I saw you booed. That's one of the great moments.
You as well. The Love and was it Mamas and the Papas? You're into the fat chick, right?
So that is a remarkable thing that the archive of material goes from being genuinely, for want of a better word, genuinely weird to being something that we have over 60 years massaged into a shape which we understand, that we place in the lineage of events, which weren't. This is I mentioned Rob Chapman. Rob Chapman, the writer Rob Chapman, says a great thing about he's sort of almost militantly against the idea that you can tell the Beatles story at all, because he says so many of the judgments that we make now are the judgments of history, which we can observe in hindsight. But what you've got to understand is all this happened at once.
Mm.
All this happened at once. In 7 years, everything popped off in one go.
Yeah,
that's fundamentally it. And you can arrange events in such a way that they make more sense. But that Big Bang is the thing we're all still dealing with 60 years later.
I would say the closest you get is going through these magazines, because when you read them week by week, it's beyond a time capsule. You are there. You've got the hindsight as well.
I spent a lot of time going through this particular issue and, of course, other publications from the time when I was researching the Kinks book. And what you get, as you say, Chris, is a sense of what the business was able to understand. So acts who are doing well in terms that the writers can understand, that's how those acts are presented.
Mm.
When we get on to the interview with John Walker, John Walker has clearly been having a bad time. The vocabulary doesn't exist by the interviewer, the excellent Chris Welch,
but
they don't have the vocabulary to be able to articulate what I'm reading now, which is somebody undergoing a terrible nervous breakdown.
Yes.
So the idea of people don't even really understand what the difference is between pop and rock. That's how mysterious this is to the people who are trying to ride the wave of it. Even the people who are employed on a music paper, who meet the publicists, who meet the... One thing I got from reading this was it's head spinning to think that not just the Beatles' evolution, which we're used to talking about, but the evolution of music as we understand it, as these people understand it, in 1968, has only been around for 5 years.
Yeah.
It really kicks off in 63. It's what they're drawing in is a history that is basically only five years of history. It's unbelievable. When I say it's unbelievable, we only can believe it because we have the evidence represented by these papers.
Mm.
But so the sense that everyone is making it up as they go along comes through loud and clear.
Did you want to talk about the Beatles song race?
Yes. I'll read the story. A race is on for the hit version of Beatle new LP track Obla-Dee, Obla-Da. Strongly tipped by DJs and pop critics are the Marmalade with their CBS version of the Lennon-McCartney rocker. It's arranged by Keith Mansfield and produced by Mike Smith. The song has also been rush recorded by Joyce Bond on Island, by the Spectrum on RCA Victor, by the Bedrocks on Columbia, and by the Chris Shakespeare Globe Show on Page One. Now, Page One was a record label owned by Larry Page, former producer and manager of the Kinks. Now, of those versions, Chris, which do you know? Beatles, Marmalade, Joyce Bond, Spectrum, Bedrocks, or the Chris Shakespeare Globe Show?
I know Marmalade and the Bedrocks. And the only reason I know the Bedrocks is because there's another article later on, and I Googled it. What about you?
Yes, the Bedrocks is my preferred version of the song.
Oh, really?
Of those six versions of Obla-Dee, Obla-Da, which if I wanted to punish myself, I would play in a row. I must be fair to dear old Obla-Dee, Obla-Da. When I saw Paul McCartney in concert the first time, the track which drove the crowd absolutely bananas above bananas was Obla-Dee, Obla-Da.
Oh yeah.
So it's got, you know, many people don't like it. The other members of the Beatles didn't like it. But there was a good reason why six bands recorded cover versions of it before the album was barely in the shops. Yeah, so I think I like the Bedrocks version of that best. The Marmalade version is fine. I've never heard the Chris Shakespeare Globe Show, though. I love the... What a name. Shakespeare's Globe. He's gone, I'll have that.
Yeah.
I'm the Chris Shakespeare Globe Show.
Let's hear it now.
Desmond has the barrow in the marketplace. Molly is the singer in the band. Desmond says to Molly, girl, I like your face. And Molly says it's as she takes it by the hand.
Oh dear. Oh. Well, they're no Bedrocks. That's for sure. I would love it if Chris Shakespeare claimed at the time that he was a descendant of William Shakespeare and he had received a message from his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather saying, I think Obla Di Obla Da's the track to go for. Don't do Mother Nature's Son, Chris.
I'm just Googling him. Chris Shakespeare Globe Show. Obviously.
I really want to know everything about Chris Shakespeare. Come on.
I was just looking.
Was that their one record?
According to this, it charted for 1 week in New Zealand.
Wow. Did they make any more records, though?
If there's any Chris Shakespeare Globe Show right fans now out there, please do let me know.
No, it's the sort of thing that they would change their name in 1969 to Globe
or to Genesis
and record a very rare single or album on Vertigo. Hold on. The Chris Shakespeare Globe Show. They did have another single, Chris.
Go on.
It was called Yes or No.
Oh.
With and the B-side, Getting On Back.
Okay.
So probably Paul McCartney was listening, wasn't he? And indeed, they did change their name from the Chris Shakespeare Globe Show to Globe Show.
Oh, okay.
I thought they would.
Do you think Chris had left? It's like a glitter band.
Yeah. Yeah,
not he saying Chris
a band called Shakespeare with a Z in the middle.
But, I mean, yeah, what I would pick up on that, there's so many... I mean, it happened every time there's a Beatles album, wasn't it? You get all these people struggling. Because you think it was released on the 22nd of November, and this is the 30th of November issue, and there's all these six covers. I think the most successful one to achieve that is, if you heard Ramsey Lewis' Mother Nature's Son album.
I have, I love that. I love that record.
That is the best. And apparently he listened to the album twice. His producer, Charles Stepney, arranged a few, and it was cut a few weeks later. And as far as this is the best collection of Beatles covers.
The aim was, I've actually know a bit about that record because I've written about it. The aim was to get it into the shops by Christmas.
Mm.
So they knew a new Beatles LP was coming. They knew they had a Moog synthesizer available.
Yeah.
They knew they could call on the Chicago members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And you're absolutely right. Ramsey Lewis was in it for to get an LP into the shops for Christmas. And then subsequently, as people do, look back and went, actually, I think that was pretty good.
Yes.
I mean, it's an insane idea to try and record an album of cover versions from a newly released LP and get it into the shops 3 weeks before Christmas, but they did it. So the fact it's any good at all is something of a miracle.
Yeah, well, the cover of Jeweler is like this ethereal, majestic piece of music.
It was either on Chess or Cadet. I think it was on Cadet.
Cadet rings a bell.
And Cadet, operating out of Chicago, was a pretty hip label at that time. you know, they put out records by Terry Callier and the Soulful Strings. As you say, they drew on Charles Stepney, another arranger called Richard Evans. You know, proper crate diggers stuff, a lot of those records. Very hard to find in the UK, whereas in the States, I mean, they're hard to find in the States now, but you know, they were in cutout bins for years because they didn't really do anything and now worth a lot of money.
Yeah. Highly recommended, especially his version of Cry Baby Cry, which is
wonderful.
Outrageous.
The general point I would like to make is that this is an aspect of the pop business which is about to change forever, and that is a new record will come out, a new source of songs. Let's say there was a publishing demo going round, or in this case a finished LP, and everyone would race to A, listen to it, B, find the hit, and everyone would record the hit. The song was the thing. The song was the thing. It's why Paul McCartney always wanted to own publishing, not just his own publishing, but other people's publishing. That if you had the publishing on the song Obladi Oblada, you could be certain that six or seven acts would cover it. One or two might add the hit, but everyone would have to pay you royalties for the publishing.
Yes. Yeah.
And that sense of the old guard and the old way of doing things carries on through until about 71 or 72. It's perfectly possible these days to compile versions of, say, Imagine by John Lennon, or Paul McCartney's first LP, or Ram, or even at a push, All Things Must Pass by George Harrison, out of cover versions done by a wide range of different artists, thinking, OK, it's a Beatles song, everybody loves the Beatles, maybe we can get a hit on this.
Mm.
There is an absolutely exquisite version of Isn't It a Pity? By Matt Munro.
Yes.
Produced by George Martin.
Yes.
Which allows you to hear potentially what a version of Isn't It a Pity produced by George Martin might have sounded like had it existed within the Beatles' recording lifespan. And I'm not saying it's better than either version by George, but it shows you that until relatively late, you know, you can find a version of Oh My Love from Imagine by Cilla Black.
Mm.
It's actually quite good. It's actually quite... Why wouldn't it be, you know? There's a fantastic version of How from Imagine by Helen Reddy.
Yes.
Again, in about 70 or 71.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
After which it seems like things do change. That singers like Matt Munro or Dana or whoever don't look to contemporary sources for songs. The idea is so firmly embedded by that point that you had to come up with your own material in order to have any credibility, that though that generation of singers tend to go back pre-Beatles to find material.
Mm.
But yeah. Towards the end of the 60s and into the early 70s, still people are looking for the hit, the raking through Abbey Road to see what they can find that might potentially put them in the charts.
Yeah. Just a tiny little thing here, Tyrannosaurus Rex concert at London's Queen Elizabeth Hall on January the 13th. And this was billed as part of the For the Lion and the Unicorn in the Oak Forests of Fawn series, obviously. This was, you can tell which period Bolan was in here. Featured appearances by John Peel and David Bowie. And it was typical Bolan of this period, with lots of fairies and poetry.
I've never had the stamina for this period of Bolan. I can't do it. I have tried. I do listen to a lot of old shite, but I can't bring myself to the... Sorry Bolan fans.
Even Deborah.
Sorry Mark fans.
Deborah.
Yeah, it's all right. It's fine. It's fine. I'm not gonna dunk on Mark Bolan at this point. It seems a bit weird. I can't now turn on Mark Bolan.
And then finally, there's an advert on this page. Excuse me, haven't I seen you with? And it's a very of its time advert for Sound City Power Amps, the irresistible equipment.
It's a naughty lady sitting in front of a load of amps.
Yeah, for absolutely no reason other than the pun, I guess. Irresistible.
Some of the groups who have used Sound City Power Amps include the Plastic Penny, Fairport Convention, the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, but not Chris Shakespeare's Globe Circus. That explains their lack of success, I think.
Drop your silver in my tambourine. Help a poor man fill a little dream. Give me pennies, I'll take anything. Now listen while I play my green tambourine.
So we turn to page 4, and there's a story here. Mike Rossi ill. Mike Rossi, lead guitarist and singer with Status Quo.
What?
Huh?
Mike? Any relation to Francis Rossi, lead guitarist and singer with Status Quo? What's happened to Mike?
His full name is Francis Dominic Nicholas Michael Rossi.
And
apparently went for the... But I love the fact that he went for the least middle-class name from Francis Dominic Nicholas and Michael. And then made it more street by changing it to Mike. But yeah, it's the same bloke. Wow.
Well, you're holding back with the listeners on what happened to Mike, that he ended up in the pages of the Melody Maker.
Yeah. Would you want to take over?
Yeah, sure. Mike Rossi, lead guitarist and singer with Status Quo, collapsed in his hotel after a date at Pontypool last Friday. I'm not sure this is a news story, honestly. A doctor diagnosed the trouble as pleurisy. I mean, I suppose any angle to get you in the pop papers.
Yeah.
Mike was driven to London the following day and hopes to resume work today. It's not really much of a story, is it? Francis Rossi has pleurisy.
He's been told to take things as easy as possible.
But he will, however, go to Madrid to appear on 3 TV shows. Yeah.
So nothing happened, really.
Yeah, that is not a great story, honestly.
No. I think the main thing on here is Cream break up, Clapton to form own backing group. And in the next issue, 7th of December, front page is Traffic split shock. Traffic have split, one of Britain's top groups, highly rated in America, featuring singer Stevie Winwood, have split. But they do speculate on here, you know, what will be Winwood's future now, writes Melody Maker's Chris Welch. Eric Clapton said earlier this year he would like to work with Stevie, but thought he was committed to Traffic. Now both Eric and Steve are free from the breakup of their groups. There's a strong possibility they may get a group together, or at least record.
Oh, it's a soap opera. Of course, again, now we know with hindsight what the soap opera will lead to, which is Blind Faith, of course.
Absolutely.
I like the detail here. Eric Clapton and Jack Bruce are to form backing groups and become individual attractions in their own right. Ginger Baker is to form a new group incorporating himself on drums. What did you expect? I mean, Ginger Baker wasn't going to, thank God, go to be a front man, was he?
All right.
Now, look, there's an advert at the bottom of this page, Chris, which I really like. This was my favourite bit of this particular section. And it's an advert for Musicland in Berwick Street, which was, by repute, was the best record shop in London for imported LPs from the States. So if you were ahead and you really wanted to get hold of the coolest sounds early, you went to Musicland in Berwick Street. And indeed, they seem to be playing on that, because the advert is not pictorial, it's just text, and it says, "Look in our window and you'll see new albums by..." And then it reels off a list of... who would have been considered very, very hip in London in November 1968? Shall I just run through them? Because some of them we know and some of them we really probably don't. P.F. Sloan, Doc Watson, Terry Reid, Albert King, Insect Trust. I never knowingly heard of Insect Trust before. Mother Earth, Jose Feliciano, Charlie Musselwhite, Strawberry Alarm Clock, and Richie Havens, Double.
Mm.
Presumably referring to Richard P. Havens' 1983, I think that LP's called. But I found that really, really interesting. That's like a little insight into as hip as it gets in London in 68, in the non-Woolworths world, right? In the non-WH Smith's record department world. Musicland was as hip as it gets. Look at the preponderance of blues and roots music within that.
Yeah.
Some heavy psych, but mostly it's kind of blues and roots music. Similarly, if you look at a copy, I assume you will do this at some stage on this wonderful podcast, of International Times, the kind of Bible of the counterculture, run by Miles, of course. Mm. When you look at International Times and you look at the records they were playing, you'll see a lot of those same artists. But you'll also see, very conspicuously, Simon and Garfunkel.
Mm.
That Simon and Garfunkel, in London, in late 68, are still considered incredibly hip. And it's Parsley Sage, Rosemary and Thyme, and Bookends are the LPs that they're really listening to.
Yes, yeah.
And so it's, again, how we think of Simon and Garfunkel now, which is that everybody's parents had a copy of Bridge Over Troubled Water. That's not how they were seen at the time.
Mm.
They're seen as much more alternative and arty.
Absolutely, yeah.
And no pun intended.
I've only just got it.
That's all right. Bye, Artie. And I find that fascinating. Again, we're coming back to this over and over again, aren't we? This idea that it's post-rationalisation that creates these categories.
Yeah.
That you would, if you picked up the IT or you went to this record shop in Berwick Street, you might very easily come out with a Terry Reid record and a Simon and Garfunkel record. And, I don't know, if Blind Faith were around in a couple of Blind Faith, it's all mashed together.
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't buy an Engelbert Humperdinck album.
Well, no.
But, you know, he knew his territory. But still, the rest of it is pretty mixed up together.
There's a tiny little article under Jazz News that says, Billie Holiday's life story will be filmed as I Ain't Got Nobody by David Susskind Talent Associates early next year. And it wasn't. Because according to Diana Ross, David Susskind, he was at the time, he was really vocal on his initial bids for the film rights, and hence this article. But apparently there was also Joseph Glazer, who was Billie Holiday's agent, and he held her life rights. He was also shopping for the film rights around the same period. However, there was also someone else in the bidding, Motown's Berry Gordy. And ultimately, Gordy got the rights, and this led to 1972's "Lady Sings the Blues" with Diana Ross.
I wondered
Ross.
Whether that was in the with Diana Ross in the role of Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
Can I just make an observation here? The rest of this jazz section is proper. If I had a time machine, stuff some of the rarest and most valuable records by some of the hippest musicians in the British jazz scene, you could go and see all these people just playing at jazz clubs and pubs and restaurants. Yeah. Look, there are gigs advertised by the Tubby Hayes Quartet, by Graham Collier at the Purcell Rooms on the South Bank, playing his contrapuntal forms. There's Dick Morrissey with guests. Dick Morrissey, who played the sax solo on Rip It Up by Orange Juice many years later. Mike Westbrook, an evening with Mike Westbrook, the Stan Tracy Trio. It's just... it's so weird, isn't it? It's time travel, but it's not time travel.
Mm.
You can see it in front of you, but you can't step into it.
Yeah.
So near and so far.
So we turn to the next page, and there's an article by Michael Smith, who's putting the new Beatles LP in perspective. Best songwriter since Schubert? "If only Socrates played his guitar," he says. And it's a strange...
Sick burn, Mike.
Strange article,
sick burn,
isn't it?
As we would come to say in the 21st century.
Yeah, an unusual review here. He's more talking about other reviews, isn't he, by the Observer.
Yeah, Michael Smith has basically got a bee in his bonnet about people taking pop music too seriously. He's particularly annoyed by the filmmaker Tony Palmer, who is putting documentaries on making claims for pop music as a serious art form. And I would have to say time has not been kind to Michael Smith's article, because he seems to be talking absolute nonsense to us at this point. Didn't you think when you read it? You just thought, what, mate, stand down. You know, stand down. This is not the hill you want to die on, and you are dying.
Yeah.
Every time some pop group oaf in a transport cafe delivers some asinine comment through a mouthful of egg and chips, there is a brilliant pop writer to pounce on the precious pearls and reproduce them as some apocalyptic truth, which proves that pop music is the panacea for civil rights problems, Vietnam, economic squeezes, empty churches, drug addiction, incest, acne, and piles. I wonder if you knew Frank Boff. If only more politicians broke up electronic equipment on stage, the world would be a better place. I mean, he said, someone's been working at the Melody Maker for too long, I think. Someone needs a little holiday.
And I see in the Daily Mirror that the decision of a pop couple to have a child without getting married, quote, represents an entirely new way of thinking, which the previous generation doesn't understand.
He absolutely loses his shit at this point, doesn't he? It's like Peter Finch in Network. He goes, what a breakthrough! What will these pop giants think of next? That peace is better than war? Yeah, it's really... Actually, that does remind me of one of my favourite quotes from an interview by the great Randy Newman in Q magazine in the 1980s. He was talking about U2, Chris. Mm. And I believe it was David Hepworth, asked him, what do you think of U2? And he said, you know, Dave, I was against world peace until Bono came out for it. But then he sang that song and the scales just fell from my eyes.
Yes, I have seen that. I have seen that.
So, you know, Michael Smith may have had a point. If only Socrates had played guitar. If only Beethoven had been able to write masturbatory music. If only Shakespeare had thought of a line like happy birthday to you. Well, probably Chris Shakespeare had that covered. Yeah. That was probably his third single he didn't make. Anyway.
But I love the conclusion.
What a weird art. What a
strange conclusion
article.
As well.
If only some people would own up. That's weird, isn't it? If only some people would own up. It's like the people who, a few weeks before we recorded this, there was a big poll of books in The Guardian about the greatest books of all time. And people on social media really got their knickers in a twist about it, very annoyed about it. And people say, these are the books that people lie about to make themselves look good. And no one actually likes them. They only read them to impress other people. And I thought, I literally don't know anyone who does that. Nobody does that. As someone, Graham Swanson on social media said, just get it in your head. No one pretends to like something as a way of getting back at you. And that's what I'd say. That's what I'd say to Michael Smith here. Calm down. Calm down. That conclusion, everyone needs to own up that it's all a sham. You know. Maybe don't work for the Melody Maker anymore then, Michael. It's not a good place for you.
No. And that's the end of part one. However, you can listen to the whole interview at patreon.com/eggpod. Join us next week, where Ray Davis goes through Village Green track by track,
Chris Welch reviews the latest singles, and there's a race on to cover songs on the Beatles' White Album. And believe me, there's much more in this marathon episode about the 30th of November 1968 issue of Melody Maker. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. And again, this issue of Melody Maker is online at iamtheeggpod.com. But for now,